Most of what I have learned from Father Terry are the kind of the fundamental gut feelings of our disease, our dis-ease. That simplified that even somebody who's a recovering genius like me can understand. So please join me in welcoming Terry.
My name is Terry.
Hi, Terry.
I want to know when this meeting ends. Usually it... I worry about it. Just give me a hint. Usually go till 8:30?
Yeah, about 45 minutes an hour.
Okay, well, if I were you, I'd want the speaker to know when he should shut up. Hello, my name is Terry. I'm qualified for both fellowships redundantly. I received hope in my life, changed from cynical negativity to hope and connecting and sort of making connection with people. And I thought, what's that strange good feeling I'm having? And so I know I cheered up. I started cheering up about after going to meetings every day for 4 months, 5 months. They said, well, some of that's love. You're starting to love people. Oh, really? Yeah. And they're loving you, and you're accepting it. Oh, anyway. As I say, I qualify redundantly, and the first part of my own personal experience with this disease was very close to home. My father was alcoholic, and I remember him after a drunk. This is not in good taste, but here, this picture, he'd have nosebleeds, and he was sort of, he'd be hungover, trying to stop that from happening. And it's very scary when you're a little kid, somebody has a big thing coming out of their nose. And you know, children don't think, they just kind of react. Remember one time when my mother was taking us kids, got us in the car, and we were going away, and he was chasing us on foot. It didn't last like this. I know, but this is not good. And when I was just 6 years of age, I remember him crashing through the window. Grew up in Hawthorne. We had these French windows, you know, with the curtain on the inside, screen on the outside. They open in, I think. And he was drunk, and he lurched and lost his footing and went through the French windows with the curtain, the glass, the screen, into the driveway. And I thought, this is going to be hard to fix. I remember that thinking, oh, this is going to be tough job. And I remember the scene of him leaving the house after, I don't know, is that, you can't keep track of that when you're pretty young, but he was being helped by his mother and by his little sister to get into a car to go to a place to detox. And that was the only thing in those days. They had little detox places, and you go in and detox and then come out. And they took him, and he needed to be helped in the car. And the next morning, we had a report that he was dead. He died that night. Daddy died. So we kind of looked at each other, five kids. But I knew that. My mother was one of 10, and two of her brothers were alcoholic and around They're on Skid Row, off Skid Row. We lived in Hawthorne, and the five car went from Eagle Rock to Hawthorne. And if you were on Skid Row, then a nickel, and you could make it to Broadway, put your nickel in. When they kicked you off the streetcar, you were three blocks from our house. By the way, which is just two blocks from the Birch clubhouse down there. And so we had these visits, and I remember kind of the rule was you can't make, if you're drunk, well, if you're drunk, sick, you can stay in the boys' room in the garage. I was in the garage. We had a place, it was a place for my brother and I to live, army bunk beds, a little dresser, and we had an iron cot, the detox cot. This whole room was about 9 by 12, 9 by 13 maybe, like that. So we would have people detoxing there once in a while. So I got interested in alcoholism even more. They have kids in those days, when the bishop came to a Catholic school for confirmation, usually the 7th and 8th graders would be prepared for the sacrament of confirmation. And we were all nervous because he had asked questions, you know, about the faith, catechism questions. And I was so nervous that I just raised my hand every time he asked a question. And I answered all the questions. No one else would raise their hand. It was just out of sheer nervousness. And at the end, he said, "Everybody, stand up now. You don't have to do this, but I suggest you raise your right hand and take a pledge not to drink till you're 21. And I did that. And when I got done, I just said, "Well, I took the pledge." Oh, I said, "Don't worry, nobody keeps the pledge." Yeah. And I kept the pledge. I didn't drink till I was 21. And when I was a sophomore in college, I wrote a 45-page paper called Alcoholism. I went to a few meetings for research, read most of the big book, and became the village expert on alcoholism. And I was in the seminary already. I went to the that just horrifies people now when I tell them. They used to have a junior seminary. And you could go, you didn't go behind the wall and never come out, but you started with the intention of studying to be a priest, you know. And I did that. And for the first couple of years, you mostly go, sometimes you're bored there just so you don't have to drive far. You go home every weekend or every night. And then the last couple of years of high school, you stay there all week and up, a couple of weekends a month. And I did that. Seemed pretty normal to me. And wrote this paper, and I became, as I say, I got to go to AA meetings and read a lot of stuff, meet sober alcoholics. And I thought, well, this is all for the good. And in the meantime, I was living with the legacy of a sick family with no perspective. I had no place to look at the family from. I was in it. And I guess most of us are that way till we get to the program. But I had to say that I had very low expectations of grown-ups would be understate the matter quite a bit. I learned to fully expect incompetence and there being no money, no time, and the one in charge is incompetent. I adjusted to that. I didn't know I adjusted to it. I don't think we know we adjust to our families. We adjust that, how are things going? Okay, usual, you know, little throwing up in the living room and stuff like that. But we got stuff that wipes up pretty well. You know, it doesn't, you can't tell the next day. And I think that was my legacy from that I had to bring to my Al-Anon recovery is low expectations. It's very difficult to disappoint me. I'm hardly ever up upset. And that's just because I don't think you're ever going to do anything. I don't think anyone's going to come through. I think there'll be no money when we finally need it. And so everything's a surprise. And with that, did I already mention the seminary? The rector of the seminary was two seminaries, the junior seminary and junior college. Studied philosophy for the last part of college, and then 4 years of postgraduate work for theology. The rector of the one seminary then was a different rector for the second seminary. And when I was ordained a priest, I found out that both were drinking alcoholics. The whole time I was there, the main man was a drinking alcoholic. It creates a certain mood. Not a real close, cheerful, hopeful mood, kind of a, just a polite, distant negativity. And I began to drink in the middle of this, and I didn't go, you know, start raving mad, but I did. You know, I didn't. I have a lot of trouble with them right away, but I had my first. I made a couple of Manhattans on my 21st birthday, and I got a recipe out of U.S. News and World Report. They used to staple those. Southern Comfort was staple their ads in news magazines and give them recipes for cocktails. And I got one of those, and I followed it. And my mother told me later that she thought, well, maybe I wouldn't have any trouble with my drinking because no one in my family's history had used a recipe so far. It was the last time I used a recipe. But I drank up everything that was there, the leftovers, finished off the sweet vermouth, and liked it. It wasn't that I liked it, it was hope. If you can feel this way sometimes, maybe you can stand it in life until you'd have to die. That's something anyway. And I was a little embarrassed, you know, that's not too spiritual, it's a chemical ethyl alcohol gets to the brain and begins to destroy it. And the first part of being destroyed is pleasurable. The trick is stop destroying, you know, to quit just when it's destroying it too much. Which nobody can catch on to. No one's got that one down yet. I was still in that very structured life, but I drank alcoholically every time, even though that wasn't too much. Alcoholic drinking is not just, it isn't necessarily excessive. You get some people who are daily drinkers, and some people really don't notice they ever drink. But when I drank with consuming interest. I know where the bottle was, I know how much was in it, I know what time it was, I know how many feet it is from here to there. And I went through the last years of my seminary that way, and having sometimes of getting pretty intoxicated in a bad place. And I thought, well, I'll go to confession. the rector advised us to take a pledge not to drink for 5 years when we were just 2 years from ordination. Just take the next 5 years without drinking. It'll be good for you. You get a start in the priesthood with a sober person. And if you have a problem later, you can do something about that. You should do something about it. But just don't drink at all. Well, I thought, oh man, I just barely got done with my confirmation pledge. And so I decided, and I was worried though. I thought I was an alcoholic in the early phase. I thought, well, I get to drink a little more before the showdown. Something like that in my head. And so I had this thing of, I didn't like beer. So I said, I'll take a pledge not to drink any more than one hard drink in any one day. That should do it. And the result of that were that I learned to love beer. there were two guys, I remember their name, Tom and, it was Tom and Jerry, I think. Honestly, God, and that didn't even come out that way. That's their name. They were arguing who could drink the most beer. They were going to have a beer drinking contest, and I volunteered to be the judge. And I won. It's always a sign, you know. To win the contest you're judging is a sign. And then I would have so much time not drinking, you know, then not drink for quite a while, just from circumstances, especially in the seminary. And I had that one, only one drink day, and that was still before ordination, and that's in an alcoholic mind, it's only one drink. And one of my best buddies, a classmate, and we had different jobs that summer. I was in Rosemary Reed Swimsuit Factory, hauling industrial sewing machines. It was very unglamorous. But someone gave my buddy a bottle of Demerara rum, some 151 proof. And I thought, well, you know what we should use this for that one drink during the day. So we thought we'd make a zombie with some fruit juice and light rum, dark rum, and then a lot of that 151 on top. And so for my one drink. And when we were done with it, my buddy was lying on the floor, on his back, very peaceful. Just and I was looking up at the clock, just like that, across from it was a 11:45. I thought, only 15 minutes till tomorrow's drink. just in case you weren't acquainted that much with the brain functioning of an alcoholic, it's just relentless. It doesn't let up. And so I was ordained a priest and then on most days did not drink. On the days I drank, about half of those days, no one noticed I drank. And I hardly noticed it because I didn't get too much. And then the days I couldn't get up and got home real late and would stop. I liked to stop at Skid Row bars because I didn't have much money, but they're the cheapest drinks in town are on 6th Street, 5th Street. Would make my way home. I'd feel, you know, guilty and hungover and terrible and quit. I quit just a lot. And it was, you know, those awful things of having the, maybe we shouldn't put all this stuff in, but, you know, it's, you think, well, how could a priest, well, I know, later, when I was leaving that place and on my way to detox, I told the other young priest who had the altar boy responsibilities, I said, call off the investigation of the altar boys. I've been the one drinking all the Chablis, altar wine. So leave him alone. All right. And I would go without drinking, then be drinking scotch a while and paying bills and doing all kinds of work and then thinking, well, I can do some pretty good work while I'm drinking. Then I naturally think, well, you can work and drink, and then you find out you really can't work and drink. That was an illusion. And I drank myself out of that parish. I got home at 20 minutes after 8 for the 6:30 mass. I don't mean I got up, I got home. And I said to the old man, I guess this is it. Yeah, this is it. And I, so I thought, I think the thought of Alcoholics Anonymous crossed my mind a few times during that time, and I was sent to an aversion treatment hospital up in Seattle where you get to treat alcoholism by giving a nausea drug and pause a few beats and then give you some alcohol to drink, and you get violently ill, just beyond anything like normal nausea, throw everything up, and give five of those treatments. It takes you a day and a half to get over the treatment, and do that 5 times in 10 days, and that's supposed to keep you sober for the rest of your life. I went to Schicksal Hospital 5 times. And I didn't think it worked exactly because I drink again. But once I was drinking, as the Al-Anons, the pure Al-Anons here, do we really want to stop drinking? Just desperately want to stop. I'm going to do it. But when I thought of going to AA, I thought, if I go to AA, they'll tell me it's a disease. I know that. They'll tell me the first drink gets you drunk. Let me tell you. And then they'll tell me I need God's help. Thank you very much. I got all that stuff. You know? What I got to do is focus, concentrate, and bear down. That's what I'm going to do. And thank you. So I wound up going to this aversion treatment place, and they sent me once, and I've actually told people they kept sending me back when I would relapse. Well, they never sent me back. I went back on my own. That was the only thing I knew that made it stop for a while. And I went back 4 more times. I was a 5-time loser from Schicksal, and they asked me never ever to call them up again. I was becoming real bad news. Bad news for, they don't want people walking around saying I was there 5 times. One of the things about alcoholics is that once we get sober, we feel so normal. And if you don't want to not drink, and you're determined to, and you're therapy, and you're taking some, and you're going forward, you think, well, okay, I think I got it this time. And of course, then there's the light changes the way it came through the window. I think I need a drink. So I was still having relapses after I was kicked out of Schicksal's, and I wound up being sent to a psych ward to get detoxed. I was the only one detoxing. Everybody else was righteously mentally ill. And I went through there like a champ. I was pretty calm. I even became the Scrabble champion of the unit. And it was several years, a good number of years after that, I brought that up at a retreat with men, that I was the Scrabble champion of the psych ward at Queen of Angels Hospital. And one of the guys caught me later and said, Father, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but I'm a psychiatric nurse, and they teach us to let the patients win. You'd think you could have held back. And that was, as I was leaving, I had what I now consider a spiritual experience, a gift from my higher power. And it didn't start out as a feeling like a gift at all, but it was an awareness, everything got real still and clear. And it was what I think right now is my higher power let me experience my alcoholism. That I was ready to go. It was obvious to me that I would drink again. And then until I couldn't drink anymore, and then I wasn't going to keep these good connections to go to a good hospital for long, and I'll be detoxing in someone's garage or some little room by myself someplace, and that I would do that until I became apathetic, boring, the pain in the ass to all who knew me, and then I would die. That's very calm. That at least I know. I feel better than I know. That's settled. It sounds so, but it's, I call that a grace, totally a grace, because that's the truth. It's that insofar as being aware of no other kind of help, that's just exactly what was going to happen, where I was going. And I had the great good fortune for it to be suggested that I go to a little place in New Jersey. And the place that was only open about, it was open about 10 years. I think I got in there about the sixth year. And it was just an old house. The decor of the house was built before the American Revolution. And then it was kind of added on to, I think there were 9 floor levels in the building, second floor. And I was in a dormer in the attic with Father Johnny Walker, believe it or not. And we went to meetings every day. And you know how they take a brown van and take people from the place and they shove you into the meeting? The guy running the place was an Al-Anon. He knew better. He wasn't going to have a shiny van carry you around. We had a 51 Plymouth and a station wagon, old station wagon, and you, $2. Yeah, I want you, you have to go to an AA meeting and you have to give me $2 for gas. So we pay up I got used to that, it was okay. Even then, but there was a guy in there, his name was Ralph, he had a red toupee and he was from North Carolina. When he was a teenager, he was on a chain gang already for his behavior with alcohol. And was let off the chain gang on the condition that he would leave North Carolina and never come back for the rest of his natural life. And that's a deal. And he got to New York and kept drinking, but he found AA in New York with Bill Wilson and those people. And then decided he wanted to be a priest. In those days, they didn't even consider the possibility of a seminary and going to AA meetings. You see, it'd be well. And he went through and was sober for a few years after ordination. He got drunk and had an awful time. But because he was so hip to the program, I was there 5 months. He was there 3 months of it, and he left his hat. He gave me his Russian hat, which you needed in the winter in New York, New Jersey. But he was a good sponsor to me just by being more experienced. And then I got to be kind of a sponsor as he left. Johnny Marr came, and he was a cutter. He would slash his arms in this despair and detox while he was detoxing. So he arrived with bandages from his wrist to his elbow and not cheerful. he liked country western music. I don't like country western music, but we had country western music on the way to meetings, on the way back, for sure. Johnny was there, you know. Johnny needed all the cheering up he could get. But we became good friends. And so I got to be somebody to Johnny that Ralph was to me, even while we were in that situation. And I cheered up about, I was there for almost 6 months. And about the fourth month, I cheered up. And the cheering up It wasn't until a few years ago that I started reflecting on that, those last month or so, that it was so different. What happened? What was going on to give that light feeling, that full of hope thing? And did I sense that God was finally giving me what I wanted? You know, I think all of us should pray every day, thank you, God, for not giving me what I wanted. Alcoholics want to have our own way and get away with it. And I'll be sober, but as long as I have my way. Al-Anons want everyone to behave around them and take away their dignity and their capacity to be free, operating from the middle. Just behave yourself. And the disease says that, not. But I cheered up. And as I reflect on that, I think of the greetings we give one another. Now, when you go in, I've got a lot of greetings when I got here, and I've given a lot of greetings to people I know. And when we greet one another, I think the whole program is in the greeting. Something, when it goes on and on, and if I might, I'll give you my version of what is implicitly said. What's explicitly is, hi, Sally, good to see you this week. Give a little hug. You think, well, that's all he's saying. Well, and then that kind of thing goes back and forth. Then Sally starts greeting other people. Well, I think implicitly we're saying this. Hi, Sally. I judge you to be a child of God with the dignity of anyone else on the face of the earth. I judge you to be a center of responsibility and freedom, and nothing will do for you but the best. And I judge you to be a sick codependent who needs massive help. You will be a pain in the ass to all who know you. And then Sally says, same to you. But the first part of the greeting is the important part, but the last part is important. It's all said together. I judge you to be a child. You have the dignity of anyone on the face of the earth. You are a center of responsibility and freedom. You're not going to be given this, get real strong. No, you're going to be somebody who opens up and listens, and it'll go through you as a child of God, with the dignity. It'll be in your mind. You'll think things over. But it's going to be a message that you didn't make up. Your dreams do not come true. Your dreams are so sick that you should thank God every day they didn't come true. That everyone will behave in the way you want them, so that you have automatons going around you. Being greeted that way is a big deal. And I'm not greeted as the person I want to be. I want to be one hell of a guy. I want to get it together. I want to get it together enough to be competent in my work, be friendly and helpful in my relationships, and be widely recognized for being one hell of a guy. Just a little ego in there, a little ego and control. And when I'm in that that mode, one of the great mercies of our higher power is that the higher power does not answer our prayers the way we pray them. Much too kind for that. we get to come alive in a way that we cannot picture. I think I can't picture ahead of time at all coming alive to having my heart touched and just being an instant feeling of love and greeting to somebody who looks terrible at their first meeting. Has anyone ever prayed for that? God, I think if you just give me the grace to be able to not just be fair and kind to somebody, but to, from the inside, that I'd really brighten up and have my heart moved and just love to see a newcomer who's just full of herself and determined to get her way and control the whole world. That I just, thank you for letting me meet so many of them. And that I would then just, that I have no power over this person. I would send to greet them the way I was greeted to begin with. And some people finally, without knowing what's going on, that we let that greeting touch us. And as it touches us, we respond. And we start greeting other people that way, and we start coming alive. We can live with ourselves. And what goes on there is tolerance and love with a release. I've always said, and even though I go to mostly AA meetings, that the Al-Anon Fellowship has the finest focus on the issue. The issue. The issue is to be alive and love your brothers and sisters and granting them their freedom, which makes you not at the mercy of the other person because you've granted them freedom and lets them be truly granted freedom. There's room to be yourself and to have your heart touched. And I don't think that anyone has ever prayed for recovery in this fashion. I never did. And yet this is what I kind of consider the prayer that makes sense to pray when we're in the disease of alcoholism, either as a primary alcoholic or when responding to it in ways that the culture helps us go in a direction where we lose hope and have our hearts broken and feel like we're in a desert and nothing's happening. But in this greeting, the back and forth, the greeting together with the program that steps and the whole structure of the thing kind of gets us, it touches us just enough to be a good sport. I mean, to be a good sport means to take a suggestion to do something that doesn't make any sense. That's not going to get me what I want. I want to get him sober. Forget him. Greet the next five people to come in here. And then there's some steps. And when we start doing that, we do this fundamental, deep, spiritual action that we're born to make, to do. We're born to be respected and loved and trusted. And we're born to love and respect and trust other people. And when the relationship grows up in that spirit, we receive something that we never prayed for. You can't pray for it because we cannot imagine it. If we got everything we prayed for, we would just be, you know, wouldn't be here, that's for sure. You know, we'd be someplace, but it wouldn't be here. You'd be, you know, stuck with all kinds of stuff and disappointed again that the other people are not cooperating. Despite of all I've done for them, did they cooperate? No. And here we're, and it's so counterintuitive to let go, let God, and let every, grant everyone their dignity and their freedom to be who they are and going to do what you do next. I know it, I have suggestions that I see other people taking, and it looks like it's good for them. And I secretly took a few suggestions myself and tried it out. And it seems healthy. It's really a surprise that it's healthy. It seems like giving up in the bad way, when giving up is really giving up in the good way here. As we do that, our hearts come alive. And as our hearts come alive, there's a certain, and this is, forgive me, I'm kind of going out of describing my experience now, at least trying to describe the recovery for Al-Anons and AAs. One of the things that happens as we let ourselves be suggested away from trying to get through life in our way, show up, come to the meetings regularly, talk to your sponsor, do the steps. Okay, already. But as we do that, the pain that's right in the center of your heart goes down. Something goes down. That the anguish of the broken heart, the anguish of having relationships, love not working, life not working, it just doesn't work. I can't, then when I even get away from them, I'm away, then what, you know? I'll find the right person, then we'll, are you the right person? reminds me of my little niece, who's now a professor, but she was told not to talk to strangers, and so she went right out of the house, down the street, for some men working on a house, and said, "Are you a stranger?" Anyway, but when it goes both ways, when I'm greeted, and somehow after the 10,000th greeting, something changes, and I'm a trusted person who they all know that I can live a program that will be sane and healthy and lead me to some sanity and joy. It's happening. I'll be damned. It's and then the both of us, everyone, A's and Al-Anons, when we follow the steps in with a sponsor, in a community, in a group, with a lot of give and take, with many people, and taking the actions, it seems. Anybody could say, look from the outside, well, that's pretty wholesome. I gotta give you that. It looks a little boring, but gotta be, admit it's wholesome. Not gonna get in any trouble doing that. But it's not just not getting any trouble, it's having that pain, it's right about here, the pain that says life doesn't work. And you don't have to pretend anymore that it does. It doesn't work. You've tried as hard as you can, it doesn't work. It's kind of messy to shoot yourself, so probably don't do that, but it's not going to get any better. There's a pain, and when that pain is lifted in the joy, and there's a lot of joy in this room, in our gathering before we rang the bell for the meeting. And there's that joy that where the pain goes down, the deep, deep, deep pain. And it says, it's all right. It's all right. You could be bankrupt or get a very terrible disease, and it's a bummer, to face that kind of stuff, but you're all right. You'll live through anything, and you'll live with joy in your heart, no matter what, as you greet other people and as you go to meetings. We gotta go. One of the main reasons to go to meetings is to get greeted. It doesn't matter what anybody says to the podium. They say hello. look you in the eye and say hello and know your history and that you're just, you know, you're an outlaw psychologically and socially, and maybe really an outlaw. And we're, oh, we like to get a real outlaw too. Isn't that neat when you get a real one? When they get sober. So we have a disease that never lets up. And thank God we have a recovery that always beckons us forward. And we're never done with the recovery. I know everything in my recovery is something I wouldn't have thought up on my own. You know, it really helped you to pick up somebody with a personality disorder and give them a ride home. You sure about that? You know, as we go, we find that we start turning into people. We turn into a person that you'd like to meet yourself. Because we don't want to meet perfect people. It's, I'd like to have something on you. Then I'm not afraid of you, you know. You hear my stuff. We're relaxed now. They got a record. So with that, I will salute you and say, let's praise our higher power and keep answering the invitation he's giving us in the fellowship to do the next dedicated thing according to the 12 steps, and it'll just drive you happy.